Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 235, Buddhism and Cultural Creatives.
I haven't been online much lately, but I hope to soon. And I hope the audio here is good. I have a nice mic here nearby, and I never know if it's really going on the mic. Is it going on the mic properly? I hope so. And I'm very happy to talk to you, and I get quite a bit of feedback from people that is pretty positive, and it's not that I need positive for my own vanity, although I'm not devoid of it, of course. I don't pretend to be. But it's that makes me feel it's being helpful to some people that I get online and I try to talk about what I've learned and what I'm still trying to learn and this and that. And I have several topics I want to discuss today. One was about the whole issue of unifying sort of Buddhism, yoga, Hinduism, and actually what this one sociological study of about a decade ago, maybe a bit more, which was called, I think the title of it was The Cultural Creatives, in which it presented a little more hopeful scenario for the American population, our American population, which has seemed to regress from mainline Christianity. If you look for since the 60s, you know, the 60s was a big revolution in America, actually. You know, wasn't a political revolution that Bernie wants now, supposedly, but it was a cultural revolution for sure. And it had to do with an industrial, divorced from nature, Euro-American culture, thanks to the blessings of vision quest natural substances, like they have in Mexico and Colombia and Peru and these places, and have had for millennia, where the plants, you know, and mushrooms help humans find their place in the universe alongside the plants and the mushrooms and the animals. We're on the earth, you know, and under the sky, you know, which our Euro-American post-Western Enlightenment culture, in our desperate attempt to escape from the oppressive control of the church that was really the Roman Empire expanded rather than Jesus expanded so much. Although Jesus' lovely presence was still there. But the domineering part of it was definitely the Roman intrusion to that. And this was broken up by the 60s Cultural Revolution, very much enhanced with mescaline, peyote, psilocybin from mushrooms, and then the artificial versions of, you know, lysergic acid, diethylamide, the, dimethyltryptamines, the tryptamines in general, and so on, and sort of more industrially isolated, powerful active ingredients, let's say, you know. And but this was a big revolution. And since then, there have been two sort of major waves in American culture, I would want to say. One of which was a regression from sort of calm mainstream, mainline Christianity, which had its sort of tolerance of diversity, tolerance of science, you know, adaptation to it and so forth. A little bit split personality there between the materialist science and the sort of subjectivist Christianity, but still tolerating that split, you know, and underlying democracy and thing, and a reversion to a kind of fundamentalism in Christianity of the mega churches, where regressing into anti-Darwin, you know, anti-science, you know, sort of hoping for a miracle, and yet staying completely disconnected from nature and waiting for the rapture and using up nature, if you will, continuing to use up and destroy nature. So, and at the time of that book, I don't know the numbering today, but at the time of the book, the people who were, they numbered that that regressive group, let's say, to around 55 million or 60 million. And it, and then the other direction was sort of associated with Hinduism, Buddhism, yoga, Christian mysticism, Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, this kind of thing, going in a kind of more liberal, sometimes mysterious direction, but going in that direction. And some, a lot of it sort of non-denominational, you know, semi, still good with science and sort of not clear necessarily about whether it's materialist or spiritualist or what exactly it is. But what was good about that study was that that was an equal number, about 55 or 60 million. So that there are two split groups, you know, going in the two directions in America. The one fundamentalist one not tolerating the subliminal higher energy, more connected to nature, more appreciative of indigenous people, you know, things like the Lakotas and the Ojibwe and the different Iroquois confederation and so forth, you know, Mohawks and so on, coming back to taking pride in their native cultures, they were connected to that. Then the fundamentalists all away from all of that and more off planet, really, heading off planet. With the rapture, you know. And so it's more hopeful if you feel these two divisions are sort of equal, rather than it's all back to the fundamentalists, and then they now have their evangelical president who is undoing democracy and turning the clock back 100% on separation from nature. Let's use it all up, you know, for the, that's America, that's making America great again, is destroying the planet. And not wanting climate denial. So in a way, I'm very into mobilizing the cultural creatives. The cultural creatives seem to be much more diverse and therefore unable to act in harmony and unable therefore to withstand the onslaught of this sort of fundamentalist group that are behind, you know, the MAGA, wearing the MAGA caps and going to the, and so it's hard to get them together. So I, in all respects, in respect of the coming election, which I think is a major turning point, positive or negative, for Mother Earth herself, for Prithvi, you know, the lady who came out from the earth when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree, confronting Mara, who was challenging his ability to be a Buddha, or his right to be a Buddha even, to help beings, and who just wanted beings to continue to be swept up in the ocean of lust and hate and greed and envy and confusion, and who spoke up for him against, witness for his right to attain that because of all of his past lives' achievements, against Mara, who was questioning them and saying he had no witness for such a huge record of achievement. And she said, yes, he does. He did this all here on earth. And he started, she recited them. And in some versions, she brought 16 multimedia, like the Temptations, you know, the Prithvi Etz, the Gaia Etz, the Mother Earth Etz, singing a chorus of all his different former lives, at which drove away Mara to go back, Drat, you know, to go back to his heaven. Actually, Mara lives in a particular lust heaven. Pimp heaven, you could call it. And So there's that, you know. So therefore, my fascination, and I'm going to talk today more about what I'm calling Vajra Yoga. And we're working with students of Richard Freeman in particular, but also students of the general lineages in India coming from Krishnamacharya and different other yogis of different types, and also Qigong yogis, which I consider them yogis, and yoginis, and Chinese from Chinese tradition, and of course Tibetan yogis and yoginis from their traditions. And I would say, you know, Kabbalistic, Jewish ones, Christian ones, Sufis, you know, all of this, these are all these people who are cultural creatives who are non-denominationalist, but who somehow can never get together, you know. Like, for example, the other day I was giving a talk, I think, on some kind of Dharma thing, and then I mentioned in a connection that climate deniers were kind of out of it, and they were like, no good, which they aren't. And somebody wrote me an irate thing. This was divisive speech, because that's someone who, for example, is a wonderful cultural creative. I'm sure she is. I have no doubt. And I'm thankful for her letter even. But I'm saying it's because she also may have an idea about Buddhism. It's supposed to be some pure spiritual thing, her own idea of it, you know. And it's not supposed to be concerned with politics and the type of critical give and take in a friendly but critical way. I mean, being talking to your opponents in worldview, in theory, you know, the first branch of the Eightfold Path for the Theravada Buddhists is realistic worldview or right worldview. And or that means right belief and right worldview. And that involves being critical. Wisdom is not just staring without thought at the sky. Wisdom is critically knowing correct from incorrect, realistic from unrealistic, right from wrong. That's what wisdom is defined as in the Buddhist literature. And therefore, critical and debate, or Dharma combat in Zen, and debate is where it's at. So divisive, in a way, it is divisive, yes, but it's divisive on the basis of love of your opponent, trying to help them free themselves from their confusion. And people who are climate deniers, there are two of two kinds. One, they're just plain confused by bad propaganda by the oil and industries and lobbies and politicians and huge invested, powerful, wealthy faction on the whole planet, not just in America. They're confused by them, so they really think there isn't that, and in a way it's less their fault, but still they're confused, and they therefore need to have their propaganda critiqued, whether it's in their mind or in the mouth of Rush Limbaugh or in the mouth of David Koch. Or Charles Koch, you know, they are dividing them from nature by that confusion. Somehow it doesn't matter what we do, we can burn as much coal, as much oil, as much gas, as much release as much methane, chop as many trees down, whatever we like, doesn't matter, God's going to make new ones. You know, that kind of confusion. They need to have that critiqued. And that is Dharma speech. It's dharmically divisive speech, put it that way. And then the bad guys, the blue meanies, who know better because they know science. They use science to extract their oil and their coal and their do things. And they know that they're ruining the air and they're killing people. Huge coal-fired power plants releasing tons of mercury and all kinds of deadly carcinogens in the air and creating asthma in people where they die by the hundreds of thousands. They're killing people with this, and not to mention all the climate disruptions that are causing earthquakes and floods and sea level rise and glacier melting and droughts, and millions of people are being killed, and also creating moving tropical diseases into temperate zones where people don't have resistance to that. This is killing people. And so they have to be called out. And that is divisive. But actually, I don't hate Charles Koch. I don't hate Rex Tillerson. I don't hate the Exxon people. I might say they're a bunch of turkeys or something in a rhetorical way to provoke them maybe and get them to listen up, even if it's aggressively. But I'm doing it, out of love for them. When they do things that cause the death of millions of people, that's not good for them, basically. So when you oppose people who are pursuing murderous policies, if you do it by hating them and wanting to murder them, then I agree with you, that's not dharmic. But if you do it by not wanting them to have the terrible karma of killing many people, and instead want them to be happy by connecting to the people and realizing ethically what they're doing, how it affects the other people, and empathizing with the people, the victims, and therefore not killing them, restraining their future killing, you're doing them a favor, actually, whether you do it forcefully, fiercely, or not. And you can do it also very effectively when you're happy. And you're happy if you actually do have compassion for them. Because you can be fierce. There's such a thing as tough love. There's fierce compassion. And that is Buddhist practice. Buddhism is not staring at the sky and thinking it's all one in an unrealistic way where you're not actually helping others overcome their suffering and separation, whether they're aggressively think they're top of the separation or whether they're miserably crushed under the separation. When they live in separation, they're miserable. I don't care if they're billionaires, they're miserable. I know miserable billionaires, personally. And it's a burden. Some poor person might think, oh, if I had a billion, or even a million, or even 100,000, I'd be really great. That's what a professor might think. Little capital, you know, would be great. Instead of just my salary that I always go in credit on my credit card about, you know, with paying my bills and my health and my children and this absolute criminally dominated country that we're in right now. Bernie Sanders is so correct about that. You know, the medical industry, insurance industry, pharmaceutical industry is out of control with industrial commercialization rather than concern for suffering patients. You know, there's no question about it. He's absolutely right. And so that's the thing. So there are two kinds. And if you think I'm actually hating these people and angry, thank you for writing the letter, because I shouldn't hate them and be angry. But actually, I don't, actually. I like them. I like Billy. I was for Mike Bloomberg in the last debate. I thought he was cool, except the moderators hated him. And they knew that if they didn't give him time to speak, that the others would just bash him. And this drew poor Elizabeth out, who's such a wonderful person, the world's greatest person. But it was really, I think, inelegant to shout at him about where's his non-disclosures and whatever, you know. Although they are not nice, his non-disclosures, I do agree with her. And he has done, and his frisking stuff was not nice either, even though Colbert made a great joke that if you didn't see it, I have to tell you, was very funny. He said, oh, Mike Bloomberg is running now. And he has polls going up in the polls with the blacks and the Latinos. And they don't mind. They feel that he's now giving them hugs. And in the past, he was frisking. And he wasn't even sparing the diapers in his frisky. But, you know, they're willing to forgive the past misdeeds if he's trying to go straight in a little bit way. And he has spent almost $4 billion for progressive causes lately. He says he goes back into climate change, Paris Accord, and more strong than that. He's led a group of mayors and governors, you know, not to get out of the Paris and even go Paris Accord is much too weak, but to go much stronger than Paris in climate. He spent billions already on that. So, you know, everybody has a few bad things they did in the past, and a person who's highly visible may be more spectacular bads than others. But listen, if Trump turned around and started shutting down every mine and every methane and every fracking and everything, we would say, okay, fine, sorry, you grabbed too many poor women. That's creepy, and you better go get therapy for that. You know, but if you're going to go in the right direction now, we welcome it. And that's the way, you know, that's the way we should be. You know, what is this stupid thing that we don't want any money in our campaigns because that would corrupt us? Why should it corrupt us? We tell the money people, you're not going to corrupt us. We're going to tax you right away. So, but give to my campaign. Then I'm going to tax you if I get in. And I think Elizabeth sent some guy, oh, the horrible casino owner, Sheldon Adelson, who gives all bad money, dark money everywhere. She wrote him a letter, I think, an email or something, or an ad, say, telling him exactly how much she was going to tax him. That's the right way. And then if, he got scared and he donated to her campaign, why would she refuse it? She would tell him, I'm going to tax you this much. I'm not going to make you a special interest. But if you're willing to reform yourself and spend money in the right direction, I welcome you. Amy Klobuchar, bless her heart, she did say she welcomed Bloomberg on the stage and in the campaign. And then, of course, she attacked him. Although she couldn't reach that far, so she attacked Buttigieg next to her, mostly. So, you know, now you think maybe, oh, my podcast, I'm supposed to be Buddhist. Why am I talking about politics? Some people might think. But if you're into the Dharma and Buddha Dharma or any kind of Dharma, and you're trying to develop spiritually, you should be concerned with politics right now if you're an American citizen. If you're inactive in politics because you're too holy and too pure, then you're actually causing harm. For example, not voting is letting the status quo continue, which is destroying the lives of many people, and not to mention destroying democracy. William Barr, you know, destroying justice system, you know, destroying a lot. And if you just act like I'm sitting here pure, when you're being supported in a country by a regime that is destroying what is good about the country, then it's hypocritical. And his dharma is to inform yourself and be activist and see what it is. And without hatred, of course, compassionately, for everyone. Not hating the bad guy. If you see someone if you go on a march as an activist and somebody's smashing windows and hating them, you should restrain them before the cops come. You should say, no, don't do that. You should point them out to the cops even. That's bad. They're not doing what we want. Smashing windows, etc., you know. So being compassionately activist is a little more, involves keeping your wisdom going. True compassion only comes from wisdom. Wisdom is intelligence, super intelligence. It means knowing exactly how to go about it. Like the Women March was a compassionate march. It looked fierce, and some people might have thought the women were all just plain angry, and some of them probably were angry about Trump and everything. But the overall drive of it was compassionate, which is witnessed by the fact that they're all wearing knitted pussy hats. to the pussy grabber in chief, Harbuck Poor, who's an act of compassion, because why he grabbed so many was that he doesn't ever get anything out of any connection to anybody. Clearly, he's so armored, to use a Wilhelm Reichen thing. He's so shut off within himself, still missing his mother's love. Can't accept true inner melting, obviously. And therefore is sadistic and aggressive with people. And sadistic in his politics, for sure. This is Buddhist wisdom cultivation, is thinking realistically and clearly. There is no reason for anybody, any human being on this planet Earth to be miserable and wretched. There is no economic reason. There's enough wealth on the world, enough wisdom and knowledge of how to distribute the wealth, to share the food, to overcome the illnesses. There has been for a long time. If it was shared not in a fake dictatorship of the proletariat way, of state militarized Bolshevik nonsense. That's not even true communism, but more Jesus communalism, let's call it, of really taking care of everybody on the block. You know, and there will be disparities. Some people will be more comfy than others, but no one will be destitute and starving to death and, you know, suffering miserably of some incurable something and whatever, you know. There's no need for that, really. There's no need. And then you say, well, but there's so big a population. People will say, well, that's only because people are too desperate. That has to do with people twisting religious ideologies into justifying the oppression of women and not educating them. Muhammad never said, don't educate women. Muhammad's surahs and his channeling mediumship as a prophet of the voice of Allah, who is Al-Rahim, the compassionate one, He's not thinking women are not listening to that because they're supposed to be uneducated. He wasn't making a text because it wasn't written down as he transmitted it. It was written down gradually over the coming decades, and even some of it not for a century. And a lot of it by Aisha, his last wife. Rather a little bit young one, but anyway, lived a long time and did a lot of work afterwards. And these other ones, Fatima, etc. He was talking to the women. He was very interested in them, not just lecherously, as some Westerners have said, but also compassionately, because he had many male colleagues, and the tribal society at that time was too harsh on women. And then, therefore, and his followers, some of them were killed by the nasty Meccans who were trying to destroy his movement and who were not listening to Allah. And therefore, then the wives were widows, and then those people can be abused. And so he then took them in, and that therefore the polygamy, you know, as a way of protecting them, you know. And so he was falsely accused of kind of being a little too much of a lover boy by Western people against the Christians in Europe in past centuries and probably still. And that was very bad. He was a wonderful, great person and a great teacher and a true medium for the voice of the divine. Although, again, he didn't write it down. And so you don't know, you know, there is a way of being text critical about the Quran. And they're too fundamentalist about it, I think, some of them. But there was that great Sudanese guy. There were great jurists and mullahs and scholars, you know, who were more critical about it. And I love the one of the Sudanese, great Sudanese teacher who taught that the Meccan surahs, the Meccan chapters, take precedence over the Medina ones if they contradict each other. Because he was at war during the Medina period and he was at peace in the Meccan period, and then only had to go to war defensively after going to Medina, fleeing to Medina, because of the aggression against him and his followers by the Meccans, by the Quraysh, you know. So if you know the story of his life, great prophet, peace be upon him, blessings be upon him. Alhamdulillah, I think they say. I'm sorry, I don't know Arabic. I should, but I don't. So Dharma teaching is not just, oh, be peaceful and ignore everything that's going on. That's not the case. There will be times when you want to go on a retreat. In that case, you shouldn't be listening to my podcast. You should be meditating somewhere with your teacher's teaching and a text. And you don't be involved, you know. But that's just what, as the French say, reculer pour mieux sauter. That's withdrawing from activism to jump more strongly and capably as an activist with a greater degree of wisdom and a greater degree of compassion. You know, in the Theravada Buddhism, the Buddha teaches ethics about society. He has a sangha called a fourfold sangha, not just the bhikshus and the bhikshunis, the mendicant, what we call monks and nuns now, although they're not like Christian monks and nuns seeking isolation at all. They're mixed in with the society, but they're celibate and they're renunciate, and they're bhikshus. They live by begging. So in that sense, they have to be among people. But, and then sometimes they take retreats. But even in that, also lay men and lay women are part of the fourfold sangha that he teaches in the Theravada. And the lay people have to deal with social ethics. And he teaches a social nonviolent social ethic to them. And he teaches them to stick up for that nonviolence, and especially to use their intelligence. Prajna, wisdom, that is the one way of achieving freedom from suffering, is only by understanding. And wisdom, it's not, wisdom doesn't mean blanking your mind. It means super sharp intelligence of seeing reality and discovering nirvana in the midst of samsara, even in where they let you think nirvana maybe is a little bit outside somewhere, a little off above the Arctic or something, or off planet. There are little hints that that's not the case. But anyway, Mahayana is straightforward about it. And Vimalakirti, for example, is a total activist. He's, if you read the chapter introducing, second chapter of the Vimalakirti Sutra, describes him as a complete activist, teaching people on street corners, going into the Fed, the equivalent of the Fed, you know, where the merchants are, speaking to the king, speaking to the queens in the harem, speaking to everyone, the devils, the demons he speaks to. And he tries to calm them down, as did Shakyamuni. So, so that's about the activism, right? So now coming back to the Vajra Yoga thing, and then the, you know, I've been so delighted, you know, my dear friend, it's my main dialogue gi is Krishna Das. He's my Ram Das. Briefly, it's too bad. I wish I had gone to Ram Das's retreats. I wish I could have afforded it and had the time 20 years earlier. So I was a regular there. I only went the last 3 years or something when he invited me. But I loved the dialogue with him, and I told him about the Buddhist Hindu so-called divide. I gave a Yogi Berra statement to him. I said, well, because he asked me, he said he was upset because he likes his soul, you know, his Atma. And there's this simplistic thing that Buddhism is anatma. There's no self, or you can translate atma even as soul, although that's not as good as self. Jiva is more like soul, actually, but in Sanskrit rather than atma. But anyway, he said, I'm having a problem, Bob, he said. I'm glad you came. I'm having a problem. Can you help me? I heard maybe you could help me. And that is, my problem is, I like my soul. I'm a Hindu. But all my friends are Buddhists. And they all tell me I don't have one. And I can't have one. And this makes me unhappy. Because I like mine. And I think I do have one. And then I told him what actually Dalai Lama also has agreed to decades ago. Of course you have one. But it's a selfless soul. How about that? Does that solve the problem? But I know. But the first thing I said, Ram Das, here it is. Yogi Berra has made a famous statement to solve this problem. Why? What did he say? He said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. I'm sorry, I laugh at it myself, but I'm not laughing at myself. I'm laughing at Yogi Berra. So that means you have a self and you don't have a self. Okay? Your soul is not a self soul. So in a way, you could say your soul doesn't own you. You could say you don't own your soul. You could say your soul owns you, though. So in that sense, you have a soul. And that means that when you get to your soul level, you're beyond your small personality level. And Hinduism teaches that just as much as Buddha does. In the famous Upanishad, where they go na iti, na iti, na iti, where this Upanishadic sage, I think Yajnavalkya, but I forget, frankly, exactly which one of them, but I think Yajnavalkya is talking to Indra, the god Indra, and he says, well, what do you think yourself is, Indra? You know, he's a god too, Indra, rides an elephant, he's like a really powerful, a divine elephant. And Indra says, well, I think it's this and it's that, and they keep saying na, na, na. And iti just means quote, you know. So na iti, na iti, that becomes neti, neti, neti. And so every time Indra says, this is myself, this is myself, they go, no, no, no. Neti, neti, neti. And then finally, well, what is it? Well, it's the supreme being, yourself, one with Brahma. And Brahma, of course, is the whole universe. Brahma was God, the creator, within that particular ideology. So that's, you don't own God, but God owns you. So that Paramatma is what, and then the Buddhists use that expression too, Paramatma, Supreme Self. And they say that Nairatmya Paramatma, the Supreme Self of selflessness. So what your true self is everything, in other words. So you're one with everybody else and you're at your level of your true self. And that's why you love them all. You know, Deem Karoli Baba Maharaji, he told Ram Das, Ram Das, speak the truth and love everybody, which he did, our great saint Ram Das. Not bad to praise Ram Das, the dearly now recently departed Ram Das. It's good to praise him. He is our bona fide American saint. Now, really, you can verify it, and it won't go to his head because he passed away. It might. In fact, if it does come to his head as a saintly, heavenly being, that would be good, and it might inspire him to take rebirth again and again become a Harvard professor. But this time be Ramdas, call himself Ramdas as a Harvard professor, and teach the Dharma as well as psychic, which is a more deep psychology, actually, than the Western one he had taught in this life before he became Ramdas. So that's the thing. He should reincarnate in the psych department at Harvard and a more compassionate psychology than the one they have at the moment, which is corrupted by materialism and the neuroscience idea that there's no mind inside that brain. And he will come and Dr. Professor, PhD Ramdas, in future life will come and reject that and will show that you can be a scientist and have a soul and be loving and have a loving science, or what the great Nietzsche called the joyful science. I love that. That's cool. So, but anyway, this was in the line of overcoming this nonsense that Hinduism and Buddhism are two opposing things. There were many Buddhists over many thousand years who debated one another and were opponents in their worldview between different schools in Buddhism. And even within the same school, different interpretations. There were Buddhist-Hindu debates also between individuals, whatever their worldview was. And then there were many intra-Hindu debates. The Nyayas versus the Sankhyas versus the Vedantas versus the Mimamsas. There were six darshanas, they said, six views, six beliefs, you know, and philosophical systems, they later come to call them. Siddhantas, you know, many Siddhantas. Then Shaiva Siddhanta, Vaishnava Siddhanta. Siddhanta means like an established view or a belief. Proven belief, though. They generally didn't like blind belief. Indian philosophers. Generally not. Your view could be canceled if it was proven to you that it was blind and it was based on no good reason. Because a belief based without a reason is very weak. It's just asserting itself, just blindly. It doesn't have a foundation. So that's why it's very, you can transfer itself. It leads to the authoritarian personality. People with a blind faith belief in whatever, some kind of version of Lutheranism, for example, came to blindly believe in Hitler and anti-Semitic and all of that stupidly, completely wrongly, contrary to earlier, nicer Germanic attitude that had led to the Ashkenaz, to many, many Jewish people being in the German territories in Northern Europe, to flee the more anti-Semitic Southern Europeans, Italians, Spaniards, Portuguese, French, even English. The Germans were more tolerant, so their Yiddish is practically German. They're all blamed for their horrible, and they should be blamed badly for the horrible Auschwitz and Nazi and horrible Holocaust, of course. But actually, if you look at the larger history, there were many Jews in Germany and they were successful in enjoying themselves there because the Germans were more tolerant of them and less anti-Semitic than the other people in Europe previously because they were non-Catholic. The anti-Semitism was done by the Roman Empire in its wars against Israel. Based originally in this war, if you read Constantine's Sword, The Church and the Jews, and you'll get it, where the source of anti-Semitism in the Christian world really comes from. And it wasn't from the German natural culture. It was from the horrible Nazi version, for sure. And nowadays we're seeing the rise in the Nazi-ish type American version, which is really frightful, very, very frightening for the whole planet, actually. And anybody who thinks that saying so is divisive speech and not Buddhist, you know, you should be on retreat and rethinking that, you know. Wisdom without compassion is weak and not really real. Compassion without wisdom is also misguided and not really real. Only wisdom with compassion and compassion with wisdom are powerful, enlightened, can create the Buddha world, turn the samsara suffering world into the Buddha world of pleasure and happiness and joyfulness and kindness and love. So you need the critical wisdom to get there. You need to be able to divide to find really true, stable oneness of love. There's no doubt of it. It's the vast consensus of all the Buddhists and Hindu philosophical schools, actually. So let's forget about these differences. Hanuman and is Avalokiteshvara. Vishnu incarnated himself as Buddha from one Hindu point of view. Or Shiva incarnates himself as Vishnu and Shiva and Shakti and Buddha and everything. Or Brahma emanates as, well, they all inter-emanate each other. It's the way the Indians avoided getting usually too ferocious in their opposition to each other and religious wars and things between different versions. Their hit record on that is much better than the Western one. And between Indians and Buddhists, until the Buddhists were gone, they also did that. Like Buddha was an incarnation of Vishnu. He's the ninth, you know, Hari Rama, Hari Krishna, Hari Buddha. If you're really following all the forms of Vishnu. And from the Buddhist point of view, Avalokiteshvara, the worrying God, the kindly looking on God, the God who loves every tiny little ant and so forth, the form of Buddha, who is the worrying one, you know, because of the excessive compassion, who is the compassion of all the Buddhas. That Avalokiteshvara incarnates as all the gods everywhere from the Buddhist point of view. He appears as a god, anybody who needs a god, they say. You know, he, she, he can be female too. Or he can be an animal. He can be a planet, actually, even. The Buddhist sort of theistic, infinitheistic, I call it, not monotheistic and not polytheistic, infinitheistic. The Buddhist infinitheistic view is the omnipresence of all Buddhas throughout the universe, taking care of us all, you know, and trying to help us out of our pit of ignorance and self-inflicted, unnecessary suffering. That is their job. They didn't create it, the situation, though. And because actually, ultimately, the situation is uncreated. That's the good news. You know, I know that's complicated. Never mind, we're not getting to that. So anyway, everybody agrees the great gift of India itself is its great Sanskrit language. The Buddha chose to manifest his enlightenment in the 3rd century, in the Axial Age, in the fullest, most scientific way in India. From the Buddhist point of view, he also manifested as the pre-Socratic Saint Socrates in Europe, and he manifested as Isaiah in Babylon, collecting the Talmud for those people. And he manifested as Confucius in China and as Zoroaster in Persia. And as many, many medicine men and women in many indigenous tribal groups all over the planet simultaneously, because Buddhas do that. They don't just go and take care of one little group and say, oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't help the others. They help everyone, and they don't have to be Buddhist to be helped. And doesn't have to appear as a Buddha. But the Indian society at that time was the richest, most blessed one in Eurasia, at least. And therefore, he could have the most leeway to present the version of reality that is maybe more difficult for simple-minded people to get. Finally, you know, scientific psychology, scientific biology, scientific physics of relativity. It might be too chaotic for people at a more simplistic level that kind of want to be bossed around up to a point, et cetera, to avoid getting into too much chaos and conflict with each other at that time. So there is a total grand narrative, and it's called the Wheel of Time in Buddhism. Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha himself manifested as a Kala Chakra, as a time machine. But it wasn't the time machine traveling in some sort of rigid, fixed flow of time that is the inalterable history of the material planet at all. It is that he turned the material processes of the planet into a time machine. You could call it an evolution machine, a place to bring maximum number of beings into the human form and through the human form into the enlightenment form, into the Buddha form, to be able to therefore really create a land that would be the ultimate university for enlightened beings and kind to all the animals and helping the animals to evolve and through them and into the most best educational form, the humans with the language, you know. The gods are the more comfortable than the humans, but they're not the best educational because they're too lazy, because they're having too much pleasure. So they don't go and study their, you know, and you know, relativity 101, their psych 201. They don't want to study it. Don't bother me. I'm in my 1,000-year jacuzzi, you know, type thing with my girlfriend or boyfriend. So they won't study, you know. So the human is really best. Anyway, that's the Kalachakra vision, best of all possible worlds, which is esoteric because bad guys will use it to say, well, whatever nasty thing I do, it'll still be best of all possible worlds. And so they misunderstand the implications of best of all possible worlds. It's only when enough beings are able to understand that the best of all possible worlds means they should use their time in best of all possible ways, which means lifelong education. Lifelong evolutionary education, using their human intelligence and their ability to go into micro meditations and micro world and outer body experiences and deep one-pointed concentrations and use all of that ability to evolve as a being to where they can even then die consciously. They can lucidly dream, lucidly die, lucidly be reborn, even be lucid awakening, know what they're doing when they're awake instead of just following their inner promptings of their, you know, the Rush Limbaughs of their culture and just doing, being ditto heads to their culture. No, lucidly waking. That's the goal of lucid dreaming. Reason for lucid dreaming is to learn to be lucidly awake. To really know you're awake when you're awake, as well as be awake. Then you're much more mindful. That's why mindfulness is the root to that. That's why it's such a big, important foundational teaching. Okay, so good. So this is it. Then we come to the body yoga. Now, there are so many levels on which a few million people, I think, now in America, maybe more, are doing some kind of yoga. And the cultural creatives, all 60 million of them, are doing yogas of some kind. And the you know, some of them are doing it just for health. Some are doing it for vanity. They think they'll look better. It'll be more trim, slim, you know, it's like a sport. Eventually there might be yoga dancing as an Olympic category, you know, or Olympic gymnastics, you know, yoga gymnastics or something, probably. And that's all right, because their body is like a dancer. Your body is an instrument expressing your love of beings and wanting to inspire them to get out of their own feeling of being stuck in an imperfect body and feel that their body can express their love and affection and their appreciation of life. And so it's kind of really advanced, wonderful art form to use your body as your instrument. And yoga can be used for that. Yoga can be used, therefore, for sort of athletics. It can be used for artistic creativity. Then yoga can be used to unify body and mind, where you sort of meditate more with your body. And these are the most advanced stages of Tantra, non-dualist thing, which comes to do with having realized, you know, in belief system terms, of the fantasticality, the magicality, the divinity, really, of the human embodiment. And as an instrument for learning. You know, there's these fantasies that the tech people have nowadays, Silicon Valley and MIT and Media Lab and blah, 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 what have you, you know, Silicon Canyons in New York even, where, you know, we all want to download and become this marvelous computer so that our mind with its computer, we can be cyborgs, you know, so the mind with a computerized mind that can beat everybody else at chess, that can be the one in the cyborg field of the matrix, can bring the body with it and the body becomes a matrix creation. That's a fantasy, you know. It's in the movie, and it's in the head engineer of Google, Ray Kurzweil's fantasy of the singularity. It's expressed in that, of course, and they're working toward that. But what's sad about it and a little bit unrealistic about it, it's kind of fun that they're doing it, but it's unrealistic in the sense that we already are cyborgs. The brain is amazing. And that has evolved over billions of years of biological, scientific development, scientific in the sense of connecting to reality more realistically type development. Life after life, individuals, massive numbers of individuals after individuals being reborn and nation and tribe and planet, many other planets around the universe. And they're already soft robots. So we already have great robot bodies that our mind is in. If we knew its real inner structure and how to reprogram its inner structure, which is the amazing science of the Buddhist sciences, used to be the content of the highest libraries, the highest, most exalted, advanced reading rooms of the Nalanda library called the Ocean of Jewels, of the great library of Nalanda. And that was translated, then was burned there in India because by some people who never imagined there could be such a precious thing, just thought books are just brainwashing things and therefore burned those because they weren't their books. But luckily, the main jewels of it had been translated into Tibetan, where they were preserved in a safe, inaccessible land until the 20th century. And now we have them, and we're translating them. And it's a super... Google should be investing $1 billion in it, or at least $10 billion. But I can't explain it to them somehow. I don't know, not yet. But I will before I die, I hope. But they should be, because it's a human priority. Imagine, this is out of that, and study of that, and learning of that, and getting it into good English, and getting hundreds of people learning, it became kind of geniuses who are engineers and so forth, to develop inner auto-engineers who can engineer their own inner machinery, the brain, the software. They can develop software to program the slimeware, I call it wetware, biological hardware of the body. And the whole body brain, not just the brain, but the whole body brain, the central channel, the chakras, you know, the complexes and so forth. And the downloading all of this means moving it into a readable language. Many people need to learn Tibetan, of course, and Sanskrit to do it. And then translate it into many other languages, but to download it and then use it, the yogis to use it on themselves and become the cyborgs. They don't have to wait for 2045 and Ray Kurzweil or somebody in Google to give them a ticket. Google would be giving them a ticket by helping us translate the tenure. That is the fact of it. Because the yogis already knew how to do that. And they did it, thousands of them. And then they took it up to Tibet when India was no longer safe. And they're bringing it back now. So this is the Vajra Yoga. Just little humble beginnings we're beginning to do. And it involves mobilizing people who are expert, who are trained, whose bodies and systems are enlightened, through the lineages coming from Krishnamacharya and other Indian yogis, and really from Vedanta, also great Vedanta philosophers like Shankaracharya and so forth, and the great Buddhist tantric non-dualists. All the non-dualist philosophers, including the Shankaracharya, I'm sorry, this goes against what a lot of academic historians, even Indian ones, think, Western ones, but all non-dualist philosophers from the mid-first millennium of the Common Era, definitely we're all tantric yogis and yoginis. Definitely. The yogis were the males who were more educated and could publish, you could say, who were in the big universities. And, you know, because of the patriarchality of Indian society still, in spite of having had all these wonderful bhikshus and bhikshunis for 1,000 years in there, opening and loosening it up, it was still patriarchal. So the women didn't write that we know. They may be magically discovered. I bet they did, actually. And we find the iron library with no windows in the Swat Valley or in the air, suspended over the Swat Valley in the Udiana, it's called, the Dakini land, where to get your library privileges, in order to get them, you have to be able to hang upside down from a tripod for 3 days without dying or fainting, and remain peaceful and say your mantra and not freak out. And then they feel, well, you're kind of cool. You have a little bit control of your circulatory system and your nervous system, and you're not going to like do something nasty and wrong and evil and egotistical with the knowledge. And they let you in there. Then we might find a huge department of books written by all the great female Mahasiddhas who have not come down through the patriarchal, because of course Tibet, which although that was their refuge of the Siddhas, a thousand years ago, or 1,200 years ago, or 1,300, when the outsiders started wrecking the gentle place and the beautiful raga place that India had become, the non-dualist place that had become. But Tibetan society then was still a warrior male chauvinist society, even then, and it has remained so. But it is better and more happy and more relaxed anyway, because at least they weren't conquered until the 20th century. And then most of the warriors went in to become evolutionizing, educationizing monks. And then some nuns, but not much more monks, because they had been the warriors before. So it was a step in the right direction, but still nobody has yet reached all the way past the patriarchy, even anywhere on the planet today, but we're getting there now. We will get there. Could have got there in 2016 had we elected a mom. And we'll get there when we do elect one of these days. So that's what we're beginning to do at Menla. By the blessings of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, there is this place, the Medicine Buddha Retreat Resort and Spa, where one can go to heal, and it's a bayul, a hidden valley here in the U.S., in the Catskill Mountains, meaning it's mountains on all four sides around it, protected, out of the flow. People can do retreats there. And then we're developing yogis and yoginis. But we're not a cult that is hidden. It's not hidden in that sense. But it is a little hidden temporarily. But no one can stay there forever. Like the Shangri-La Valley, where they go and then they become young, have eternal youth. But they find the keys to eternal youth. But then it immediately has to be brought out into the larger world. Because the world needs activism now. We're in the time of planetary change. Greta Thunberg is our leader. She's telling us now, no more nonsense. And we can do that, and we have to do that. But we're trying to get cultural creatives to empower them there so they can go right back out and they can meet and unify their diversity and turn the whole education system of the country back in the democratic and the pluralistic direction and turn the industries of the country in that direction, and then also help the planet go that way, and then lead the planet in demilitarizing and creating a true world government, which they don't control. It becomes a United Nations. We have one, not just on near Wall Street, you know, not just on First Avenue there, you know, and on the Hudson River, but have branches everywhere, UN universities everywhere, branch in Beijing, branch in Hong Kong, branch in Sydney, branch in Tokyo, branch in Berlin, branch in Moscow, branch in Cape Town, branch in Lagos, branch in Cairo or in Egypt somewhere, Sudan or something. Air Kenya, you know, the UN, really a genuine UN, with the ability to see to it that there's such a thing as international nonviolent law, ethics, and that law is ethical. There's not this fake separation between law and ethics, that law and ethics are one, because they are evolutionary. Being ethical means you're using your life in an evolutionarily positive manner. So that's what law should be. There's really no whole concept that law is something different. It means that's unjust. Something different from ethics is not correct, actually. Something erroneous there, having to do with the scientific shortfall, lack of understanding the true nature of evolution and of the individual and of society. So it's allowing for an excessive degree of egotism, allowing for example, making corporations individuals to act in it, to ruin democracies, which is not possible, for example. Okay, so I think that's mainly what I wanted to talk about today. So therefore, Vajra Yoga means that you learn non-duality in scientific manner, and you fit in, and then you move to the, and you're moving your body in that non-duality to become an expression of your, to learn, like your mind learns, your body is also learning simultaneously. So we're compressing the preliminary, the medium and the advanced levels of study into a faster cycle. And then finally, your body is expressing your understanding by controlling your inner energies, your vayus, your inner winds. You're doing inner and outer vayu yoga and this sort of thing. So that's what we hope to do. We're doing experiment for that. And then, dear George Soros has given $1 billion for a new climate-oriented university worldwide connected to Bard College, which is not far from us. And then hopefully we can develop a connection with them and can become a research connector for them, and maybe offer also courses on their campus from some of our graduates who are teacher trained by us. I can't really get too far with it. I'm too old. I'm almost 80. I'll be dead, but I'm just trying to set it up. When I was told by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Reverend Geshe Wangyal, my original root Geshe, and then the Dalai Lama now is my ultimate rich teacher, and they told me, you can't just be a professor in the regular Western university. And I was so upset because I've been studying all my, working myself to the bone in real poverty to try to finish my graduate studies, was already having a family and to support. And they said, you can't just be a professor. I said, what do you mean? I just got to think that I'm going to be a professor. That's going to be my job. Yeah, well, that can be a day job, but you also have to translate the whole tenure. 4,000 books. This mother load of this cyborg technology for the human being. Inner cyborg technology. I never thought of it that way until this time. This is a good session. I like this. Thank you, Ray Kurzweil. So, come on, Ray Kurzweil. Try to get over the materialism dogma, So they said, that's what you have to do. Then when I complained, well, how can I do 4,000 books in one life and forget about it? I was only 30-something at that time. And they said, no, not just in one life. You not get that much done, but you set up institutions to do it over 3-4 generations. And I more or less forgot about that, the 3-4 generation thing. Although then I heard Dalai Lama told the president of Colombia. He said, don't you, that Professor Thurman needs at least 3 lifetimes to finish his project. Like, what? When they're having lunch. I brought them together for lunch. I didn't know what was going to go on at lunch. And suddenly he's talking 3 generations. And then the resistance of the materialist university exerted itself in a humorous, of course, and very convivial luncheon. And smilingly, Bollinger says, well, that's wonderful, Your Holiness. But unfortunately, well, too bad, we don't have that reincarnation system here at Columbia. And everybody laughed. But in a way, we do, because I have an endowed chair, and somebody has to come who will continue, who's somebody who's around 50, 45, hopefully, and continue what I started there. And there's an endowment to support them to do that. It's just they have to hire the right person. That's what my colleagues have to do. I hope they will get on it. It's bad time. Hurry up for them to do that. So we were connecting to that. And then I'm trying to make a place in India. in Andhra Pradesh, where Nagarjuna lived, Nagarjuna Konda, near where he lived, because where he lived is underwater, because they put a dam up and they have a wonderful irrigation system coming out of it, which they do need in Andhra Pradesh there, and it helps the prosperity of that area. So it's okay. But on the mountain, which is now a shore of the lake, Nagarjuna Konda, I want to make a translation center there for people to come from not only Columbia University supporting, Harvard, California, University of California, Oxford, Sorbonne, École des Hautes Études, you know, all of the Moscow Advanced Institute, Japan Institute of Advanced Buddhist Studies, Hong Kong, China, Beida, Fudan, all of them have graduate students who are into the languages and go there and study. And then neuroscientists should also go. We develop a branch for meditation and neuroscience if it goes well. My colleague is more into that, coming from MIT, the great Venerable Priyadarshi, who is my colleague and my partner in doing this. So that's my attempt to set it up for the next two generations, at least. Past the time of the singularity, actually. 2060. And I'll hopefully be a teenager at that time, maybe, or in my second life by then, who knows. Okay, so that was that. And then what else? There was one other thing I wanted to address, but I think that's about it, okay. One last thing. I want to recommend a book to everyone, especially who cares about climate. Now I'm putting my hat on of the Climate Reality Project Leadership Training. And, you know, Al Gore doesn't teach this. This is in my edition. And some people might yell and scream about it if they happen to hear that. I'm starting to be more public about it, because I am completely persuaded by a book by Joshua Goldstein called, and another co-author, I really am sorry, I apologize to the co-author, Vlimk or something, his name, it's like a Czech name or something, the co-author, very important co-author, the both equal contribution they made, called A Bright Future. But in that, they really do a corrective to our green, hippy-dippy green thing, which is itself great. And they also think it's great. But we somehow got convinced early on, because of the clumsiness of the American nuclear power industry, that nukes are hopeless and its pollution byproducts, you know, Hannaford and all the mess of, and the nuclear weapon thing and everything. We got, because we are, of course, anti-nuclear weapon, which we will remain 100%. But we got convinced that nuclear power generation is hopeless. And that was wrong. And I admit I'm wrong. That book, you know, scientific and political, but especially scientific and arguments completely convinced me of my having been wrong, because there are further generations of nuclear power generation that are infinitely less polluting as far as the byproduct, final byproduct, when it wears out, you know, after 50 years of producing terawatts of energy, when one of those power plants wears out, the amount of byproduct is so much less. It's highly potent, but it's so much less than the coal byproduct, than the oil byproduct, than the gas byproduct, than methane byproduct. It is so much less that it is just ridiculous to continue polluting. And the coal and all those byproducts, they completely are making the global warming, where we're going to have a complete catastrophe of ocean rising and everything. And the proof in the pudding is Sweden is already carbon neutral already. Forget needing even Paris Accord. They're already carbon neutral. Even they don't have all electric cars like Norway, because they're not as rich as Norway. But they're carbon neutral because they have this new generation of highly effective nuclear power filling the gap by shutting down the coal and the oil. So the renewables and the wind and the solar and the geothermal and all of that can, which they take time to get going. And we haven't yet figured a way of battery storage. And also battery stuff is very polluting too. But we haven't figured a way of getting there 24 hours and with the advanced energy needs of a mass society. And we can't sit and hope that rising ocean levels are going to just kill off enough people where we can just a few million of us live like green people. That's ridiculous. We don't want them all to die. We welcome all the human beings. We think they'll naturally, there's a natural tapering off of the climate curve, of the population curve, giving women power. Then they won't have too many babies. That's proven. It's not a mystery. We just have to intervene in societies where women are slaves and see that they get liberated democratically. And then they won't have 7, 8 children anymore. They will not. And then population will diminish in a gentle, natural way without killing anybody. Meanwhile, we welcome as many humans as we can get because they become cyborgs. They can educate. They can become great beings. Maybe go out and help animals on other planets. Help the animals. Not kill off the animals on this planet for sure. Bring them back. Making the Jurassic World. I don't know. I'm stuck in movies. I apologize. But seriously, the stage 4 green nuke should be investigated. Greenpeace, stop just being anti, period. Be anti any antiquated, horrible, unsafe one, of course. And anything that helps any kind of nuclear weaponry business, totally let's be anti. As before. But let's correct course here and realize the need for these kind of small-scale thorium reactors, this kind of thing, this kind of tech. Let the tech people do that. And that South Koreans can build one for $2 billion that will produce what $2 billion worth of coal-fired power plants would produce with zero carbon, whereas the $2 billion of coal-fired power plants that they're building in China, for example, right now, are adding like, gigatons of pollution, carbon pollution into the air, which we cannot have. It's not in our carbon budget. Yes, Greta Thunberg, thank you. It's not in our gigaton, 360 gigaton carbon budget to have that same power produced by coal or even oil or even gas. Okay? So let's build those South Korean nukes. Let's take $100 billion out of our defense budget, buy 50 of them and give them to the Chinese if necessary, to turn off all their coal ones immediately, and India. Give 25 each, or 30 to China, 20 to India, and have the South Koreans build them, and train Chinese and Indians to build them themselves. And that gives us the breather and makes us meet the half of the carbon pollution by 2030, which is when we need it, 2035, to save California. That's when we need it. Can only get there with the green nukes. In addition to continuing all the, of course, remove all subsidies from oil and goes without saying, and putting all those subsidies into the other thing. Give such kind of nukes to the Saudis and tell them to leave it in the ground, the rest of it, and make solar and to start solar industries and have an economy, proper economy, diversified economy. Okay, that's why I wanted to end on that. Get myself in trouble. I'm going to get angry letters from green people that I've been brainwashed by the nuclear power industry. No, I haven't. You read A Bright Future and hear of the success of Sweden, Ontario, and to a lesser degree, but to somewhat France, and read about the disaster in Germany from having stopped their nukes. Disaster. What the coal plants, the lignite coal is doing in Germany. Disaster. Read about it. And realize we need to give the Germans a bunch of green nukes to get rid of that, turn off those lignite coal plants at once to meet their trans Paris, double Paris we need, double, triple Paris we need. Okay, that's it. So my last very non-Buddhist, very divisive, very controversial statement of a non-scientific, ignorant, just, Greta Thunberg-crazed person, Al Gore pumped-up person, saying, reconsider green nuke stage 4, or whatever they call it, stage 4 nuke, stage 3 and stage 4 type nukes as a super green necessity, okay? Right now. Thank you. Bye. We'll be right back.
the Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share and post on your favorite social media platforms. Thanks for tuning in and hope to hear from you soon. Tashi Delek.